With the shutdown recently, this is definitely going to help with just getting a little bit extra help for him and then the bag for our daughter, too.
The government shutdown enters its fourth week. What is the impact on everyday Americans? We're out asking that question and getting the big picture from Catholic Charities USA. 20 years of missionary life in Mongolia. We go on the record with Colonel Giorgio Marengo. Some call it the Catholic Disneyland. We continue our series on Catholic hub communities. Next stop, Wichita, Kansas. And addressing the pastoral needs of deaf Catholics. Insights from a priest who understands those needs all too well. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
We do not live in a world that's designed for one income. And so when you are living on one income, you are one brake job. You are one medical bill, one set of braces away from not being able to pay your bills.
Everyday American citizens are left holding the bag as the U.S. enters the fourth week of the government shutdown. Aid groups, including some regional Catholic Charities organizations, are stepping up to help those who are starting to feel the economic squeeze. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. Week four and America's government remains closed. The House of Representatives is on recess. Senators cannot pass a bill to reopen the government. And the president goes to Asia for a week and is not around to help break the impasse. With the shutdown stretching towards November, it's not just unpaid federal workers who are getting hit in the pocketbook, but creative accounting to pay the military and fund major safety net programs to feed those living in poverty will become increasingly more difficult. In one failed measure this week on Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats on Thursday blocked a Republican-led measure to pay essential federal workers who are required to work through the shutdown because the measure would not provide paychecks for all furloughed federal workers. And no progress on figuring out how to fund the WIC and SNAP food assistance programs past November 1st or provide funding for free or low-cost school lunch programs. Republicans and Democrats continue to blame each other.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to day 22 of the Democrat shutdown. October 22nd marks another landmark. This is now the second longest government shutdown of any kind ever in the history of our country, and it's just shameful.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is day 22 of the Trump-Republican shutdown of the federal government. And Republicans have shown zero interest or capacity to reopen the government.
We have been in good faith every single day on this, and they are eating up the clock. So we're getting closer to November. It is going to be more and more difficult with each passing hour to get all the appropriations done on time. We acknowledge that, but we have to decide this on a day-by-day basis.
Donald Trump is heading out of the country. House Republicans remain on vacation, and Senate Republicans continue to offer no solutions relative to a bipartisan agreement.
But we move past the politicians, the very ones who have to solve this, to the American people. Members of Congress are still receiving their paychecks, but many Americans are not. Reporter Roselle Regis went out to talk to everyday people who are feeling the shutdown's impact in the wallet.
You know, with my rent due next week, I could take anything I can get. At this point, I haven't gotten a paycheck this month. So the free groceries is very important, very helpful.
What you are seeing are dozens of federal workers lining up for a food bank in Hyattsville, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C. With every passing day that the government remains shut down, more than a million federal workers, either furloughed or working without pay, find themselves in deeper financial strain. The partial pay federal workers received last week Friday is their last paycheck until the government reopens.
I've been furloughed before. I've never seen it like this, where, you know, people actually had to go to a food bank. Normally it's maybe a week or two or a day or two or whatever for furlough, but not like this, where there's nothing coming in.
The Capital Area Food Bank said it served more than 370 households that day, more than double the number of federal workers it was expecting. The squeeze is felt across the country. Catholic Charities of the Texas Panhandle opened the door of its Interfaith Hunger Project to federal workers, offering food boxes and pantry access.
Our take on it is if we can help them stretch the food budget out, that allows them to maintain those other things that, with no income coming in, it's going to be very difficult.
Their food pantry typically serves residents 50 or older or those with disabilities. But Catholic Charities decided to extend a helping hand to federal workers. Executive Director Jeff Goldie emphasized that the efforts reflect the mission of Catholic Charities to step up and help brothers and sisters in need. So far, only three new families have signed up, but they're expecting more in the coming weeks.
The ones that have come in so far are typically the single breadwinner in the household, which causes some challenges. A lot of those that are not coming in yet, and even the ones that are coming in now, it's very difficult to ask for help. Don't put yourselves in harm's way. Help is out there. Come to us.
Catholic Charities USA President and CEO Kerry Robinson said in a statement, if leaders from both parties do not put an end to this unnecessary shutdown as soon as possible, even more Americans will fall into poverty, and the recovery from this setback could take months or even years. In the meantime, Catholic Charities agencies around the country, inspired by the gospel, will continue to do their best to fill in the gaps and provide life-giving, compassionate aid to those suffering most in their communities. The uncertainty of the shutdown has also raised anxiety levels among the nearly 1.5 million active duty service personnel and their families.
Part of it that's really affected us as a family is really the stress of like making sure that we would get paid. Thankfully, we live on base, so we are able to continue with our housing and not have to worry about that. But it's just the stress of not knowing.
An increasing number of military families are also turning to organizations for assistance, such as the Armed Services YMCA, a military support organization that operates food banks across the country.
Since October 1st, when the government shutdown began, our food distribution sites, of which there are 22 across the country, have seen on average about a 35% increase in foot traffic. And so we have absolutely seen an increase in need. So what we often find is military families, particularly junior enlisted, which is our focus area and makes up 60% of the active duty force, they often live paycheck to paycheck.
In Northern Virginia, the Armed Services YMCA is distributing baby items for military families.
Baby care packages included diapers, baby wipes, lotion, and soap, which military spouse Kayla Burnham says are big-ticket items for most military families.
So if you happen to be out when you need it, it's a lot of money up front. Usually when I buy diapers and wipes, it's over a $100 ticket item. That's just diapers and wipes, not including groceries and other bills that you have because kiddos are expensive.
There you go. Diapers, wipies, baby soap.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Military households with spouses that work for the federal government are also feeling the pinch, as they are now down to one income.
Military spouse, I am well aware of the great need that we have for programs like this to support families and to ensure that the family back home is okay so that the service member can be their best when they are, whether they're at a duty station or deployed.
The shutdown is also causing more stress on farmers who were already struggling with the effect of tariffs on their international markets.
Though many farmers are men and women of faith, and so they rely on prayer, or they rely on the local churches to support them. They also are looking to, advocacy for opening up the government as quickly as possible so that they can access the programs that support their farms and their families.
Russell Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
Understanding just how many Americans struggle to feed their families during the shutdown will be difficult, as a critical report tracking food insecurity in the U.S. has been canceled by the Trump administration. The USDA's release of its final household food security report was delayed this week due to the shutdown. The survey has tracked the number of Americans who do not have consistent access to food for nearly 30 years under both Republican and Democratic administrations. Last year's survey found that nearly 50 million Americans struggle with food insecurity. The new leadership of the USDA canceled future reports, calling them redundant, costly, and politicized. But health policy experts argue that losing such critical data means lawmakers and researchers will have a much harder time tracking the impact of policy changes and long-term trends. An expert look now into how the ongoing government shutdown is directly impacting the American home and family, all from a Catholic perspective. We are joined by Luz Tavarez, a longtime legislative advocacy expert who serves as the vice president for government affairs for Catholic Charities USA. Luz, thanks for being with us. There is a lot we could get into. First, it's estimated there are about 750,000 federal employees who are furloughed during this shutdown, meaning they are forced to take unpaid leave from work. What's at the top of your mind when you think of all of these people suddenly not working?
Well, first of all, Catherine, thank you for having me. You know, I think what comes to mind immediately is the financial burden that many people are facing. But what I think is really important as Catholics that we dwell on is the dignity of work. You know, people want to be able to offer their God-given gifts in service to others. Mm-hmm. And being furloughed and not being able to offer those gifts is a real problem for many people. And there's, I think, a little bit of shame that goes mm-hmm. along with that.
That's a great reminder about the church's teaching about there is dignity and work, and it brings so much value to the individual, home, and family. Luz, let's talk about the role of food banks and charities right now. California Governor Gavin Newsom says he's deploying his state's National Guard to help support California food banks. And in New Orleans, Louisiana, St. Peter Claver Catholic Church has been trying to fill the gap for people in their need with their food bank program. The church's pastor, Father Ajani Gibson, says the food pantry line has been growing week by week, and he's concerned about how they will be able to keep up with their needs. Let's take a listen.
I wish that we would be able to provide for the needs of any and everybody that comes through the doors. But that reality is daunting, that more and more folks are going to need food, need care, need people to show up.
Luz, can you speak to the critical role that these food banks and charities are playing right now, and anything that you can share from your Catholic Charities colleagues across the U.S. as they really are on the front lines serving those in need during the shutdown right now?
Of course. And what I think is important to point out is that for many Catholic charities, I would say most Catholic charities agencies throughout the country, the first line of interaction with a potential client is through food services. Mm-hmm. So that's really the opportunity to get to know what the real needs are that people in the community are sharing. So not only are we concerned with the dwindling supply at food pantries, but also the growing number of people in need and then not being able to interact with each of those people. I heard someone say a couple of weeks back that sometimes the only face of Jesus that someone will see is at a food pantry line. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important that, you know, not only do that, we continue to figure out a way to provide those services so that we can figure out what's at the root of the need that families and individuals are facing. But that we also realize that is our opportunity to interact with the need.
Yeah, that's a great reminder how there's that physical nourishment, of course, from the food, but there's also that opportunity to encounter a human person. On this same note, recipients of food aid are bracing for a pause to payments from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program at the end of next week. The program, commonly known as SNAP, serves an average of 41.7 million people per month. That's about 12% of the U.S. population. Luz, what do we know about a potential pause to food stamps amid the shutdown? And what is your reaction to that?
Yeah, it's a real concern for us and for the people that we serve. And I think what we have to remind listeners about is that this is going to be a long-term effect, right? So often the people that we see at food pantries or in some of our other services are living paycheck to paycheck. So a real disruption in SNAP benefits will have a trickle effect on other bills and responsibilities that individuals have. I will share that anecdotally, some of our agencies around the country are having special distributions for those that have been furloughed by the government. So there is an urgency to try to meet the needs of these people that are dealing with this immediate issue.
Well, thank goodness for Catholic Charities. And we have been mostly focused on the immediate shutdowns, the immediate effects of this shutdown. But Luz, and you already hit on this, can you address the long-term economic impact of this ongoing government shutdown? Who ultimately will begin to feel the consequences of this?
Yeah, of course. And again, I think it's going to be those people that are living paycheck to paycheck. Those that don't normally rely on a Catholic Charities or other social service provider for support, but may have to now, right, to make ends meet. And we will continue to do all that we can, but our partnership with government is always useful in helping to meet the needs.
Well, finally, and on that note, Catholic Charities USA is not partisan, but does champion bipartisan relationships. Luz, do you have a message to Congress right now? What would you like to see happen on Capitol Hill?
Of course. We would all love to see an end to this shutdown, an opportunity for federal workers to continue to collect their paychecks, embrace that dignity of going into the office and being able to provide a service. And I pray for those in the government that are trying to figure this out, because their constituents are our clients and vice versa. And we all just want the best for the American people.
Absolutely. Luz Tavarez, thank you so much for your expertise in joining us this week.
Thank you so much for having me, Catherine.
In other news, we go to the Middle East, where big questions remain about the future of a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, now entering its third week. Israel saw a revolving door of high-ranking U.S. officials this week, including Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to ensure President Trump's 20-point peace plan continues to be implemented in the region. To Israel's frustration, Hamas has not yet returned the bodies of all remaining hostages and is searching for the remaining 13 under Gaza's vast rubble. Disarming the militant group remains a key hurdle. And on Wednesday, Israel's parliament drew the ire of the U.S. by advancing a symbolic vote to annex the West Bank, a non-negotiable for the Arab nations Trump has carefully worked with for the truce. But the Trump administration has expressed optimism the plan will continue.
There's more work to be done and bigger achievements that lie ahead. And so we're here to work on that, and we feel very positive and confident that we're going to get there despite substantial obstacles. We're going to get there.
One of those substantial obstacles happened on Sunday when Palestinian militants killed two Israeli soldiers. Israel retaliated by once again cutting off aid into the enclave and hitting it with a wave of deadly strikes. Within hours, the ceasefire began once again. From the Vatican to the plains of Mongolia in Asia to America's Midwest, there's much more news from a Catholic perspective ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
The Catholic community in Wichita, Kansas is thriving. I'm Alan Holdren here at the city's Blessed Sacrament Church to find out why. That story ahead.
We continue our exploration of Catholic hub communities around the U.S. Just 3 years ago, he was the world's youngest Catholic cardinal. Now, our on-the-record interview with Cardinal Giorgio Marengo. Why he says his life as a missionary in Mongolia is such a gift.
Unfortunately, research shows that 97% of deaf people do not go to church. And the reason is accessibility.
And a look at Catholic ministry for the deaf. A unique effort to extend the eternal word of God to a population eager to embrace him. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
This is the radio. Celebrations across Venezuela on Sunday as Catholics awaited the canonization of their country's first ever saints. Crowds gathered in city squares to watch Pope Leo canonize lay doctor Jose Gregorio Hernandez and Sister Carmen Rendiles. In Rome, among the 70,000 faithful in attendance, you could see numerous Venezuelan flags proudly displayed throughout St. Peter's Square. Pope Leo canonized five other new saints on Sunday, including Peter Torote, a lay catechist from Papua New Guinea, and Bartolo Longo, a former Satanist who dedicated his life to promoting the rosary after his conversion. Those saints were canonized on World Mission Sunday, a special day for Catholics to join together in prayer and tithing to support global missionaries who share the gospel in countries where the church is persecuted, struggling, or young. One of those mission territories is the Central Asian country of Mongolia, the most sparsely populated sovereign nation in the world. There, Catholics make up just 1% of its 3.5 million residents. Mongolia is considered the youngest Catholic community in the world because three missionaries had to completely reestablish the church in 1992 after the fall of communism. Today, Mongolia has one cathedral in its capital of Ulaanbaatar and nine parishes. All but one of its priests are from other countries. Most Mongolians practice Buddhism, shamanism, or no religion at all, and many are suspicious of what they see as a foreign religion. But Catholics say their small community is growing, and missionaries continue their work evangelizing and serving those in need. One of those missionaries is Cardinal Giorgio Marengo, the apostolic prefect of Ulaanbaatar. He has ministered in Mongolia for more than 20 years as a Consolata missionary from Italy. The Consolata missionaries dedicate themselves to proclaiming the gospel. The late Pope Francis, who had a deep love for Asia and interreligious dialogue, elevated Marengo at the age of 48 to the College of Cardinals in 2022. At the time, he was the world's youngest cardinal. 1 year later, Pope Francis became the first pope to make an apostolic journey to Mongolia, and Cardinal Marengo was one of the first to greet him upon his arrival to the vast country. Our Monse Alvarado recently had an opportunity to talk to Cardinal Marengo when he traveled to New York. As she noted to him, despite his young age, Cardinal Marengo has had almost as many years of foreign missionary work as Pope Leo himself did in Peru. Cardinal Marengo spoke to Monse about his life as a missionary in Mongolia in this on-the-record interview.
I consider missionary work, missionary life, as the greatest gift I've ever received from the Lord, because it gives me the opportunity to be more transparent to His presence and to realize how poor I am, but how gracious is the Lord to get us involved in His mission. So to be a missionary is to share in Christ's mission and to be as much as possible close to Him and attentive to His promptings, to be able to share His presence, to whisper His word to those around us. We started by learning the language, dedicating time to get acquainted with the new culture. And I think this is a characteristic of all missionaries, to spend a big amount of our energies and lives to enter into another culture, to discover the beauty and the complexity of another cultural background in order to be able to feel the vibrant side of the local culture and then eventually to share our faith with them. So, at the beginning, more than 20 years ago, the society was still moving from the post-communist regime to a new economic and social setup. And we have seen tremendous changes and a great growth of the society. And so we are happy to accompany these people in their journey.
It's a beautiful reality of missionary work, how it does allow you to enter into something completely different.
It was so wonderful to start by living with people and getting to know them and engaging in sincere relationships of friendship and mutual respect. And out of that, we came to know more the local population. And some of them, they got interested into our activities. And we started by praying and by serving the poor. especially the children of the neighborhood. And eventually someone came to see why these foreigners were there, and they realized that we were not businessmen or we were not spies. We were simple men and women consecrated to the Lord and ready to share our faith with them.
A papal visit obviously brings media attention, mm-hmm. and it allows for you to have more exposure to the work that you're doing. But there's a spiritual dimension to it. Mm-hmm. What were the spiritual impacts of having Pope Francis visit as we start to see Pope Leo kind of take off and start his own visits as well?
Yeah, the presence of Pope Francis was so beneficial, and it brought a wider knowledge of the Catholic Church in Mongolia. And I think his very person, the humble way he presented himself, even not hiding his physical limitations, because when he came he was already suffering, so he had to move with his wheelchair, and the fact that he always spoke from his heart, he was able to address the heart of people, even people of other religious traditions, and so he gained a lot of sympathy by everyone. And in this way, the Catholic Church has been more acknowledged in a way, and people were also attracted by his personal witness. So it was very beneficial to us. And when he spoke to people of different backgrounds, he was able to always touch the heart of those who were in relation with him. So it was a great witness.
What would you say are the challenges for the Mongolian Church?
We have many different challenges, but if we look at our own identity, I would focus more on that, more than the external challenges. We have internal challenges, and one of them is to grow in depth. It's a challenge, it is at the same time a call. We long to see our Mongolian Catholics taking up their responsibilities in the Church, with the sense of being aware of the beauty of the faith they have embraced and bearing witness in their individual lives when they are at work, when they are in the society. So I think one of the challenges is to provide depth through formation, training, to have well-motivated and well-trained collaborators is indeed a challenge. So we are investing a lot in providing quality training to our catechists, especially because they are the ones who are able to share their faith with their co-citizens. Mm-hmm. And so this is a challenge. I will define it as such. At the same time, we have some other challenges related to the way we perform. Sometimes we missionaries, we need to be more attuned with local culture and to be more attentive to the different aspects of this very noble and ancient culture. So one challenge is also the language. We don't all master the language at the same level, but we feel that Mongolians have the right to hear the gospel in the best possible way. So one challenge is to provide good quality translations of the liturgical texts as well as Catholic literature. And indeed, if we work together in harmony and in communion, we can overcome most of our challenges.
How would you describe the Church in the Far East, as in Asian culture, as a gift to the rest of the Church?
I think we have a lot to learn from the Church in Asia. It's very wonderful to see the history of different countries, especially the great witness of thousands of martyrs who suffered for their faith. And in Asia, maybe the Church, apart from few exceptions, has never been a large community compared to other groups. And so we have to be attentive to the different nuances of the people we live with. So when we talk about whispering, we highlight the fact that we want to engage in a relationship of mutual trust and respect and even friendship, in which we are able to share the most precious treasure we have, which is our faith. And we whisper because we love. And when we whisper, also we refer to the contemplative dimension of mission. Usually in Asian cultures, everyone understands that religious language is a language of silence or chanting rather than shouting and imposing. So when we whisper the gospel, we want to reach out to the heart of a culture, of a people like Mongolians. We need to understand their cultural identity and to be able to share our faith with them in such a way that they feel their hearts moved by the words of the gospel. So I like this expression very much because I think it keeps together the basic elements of mission.
I love that. Thank you so much, Your Eminence.
Thank you. Thank you.
This was just a small portion of our conversation with Cardinal Marengo. You can find Monse's full interview with His Eminence on EWTN's YouTube page. The White House and Venezuelan boat strikes. The U.S. Army cancels religious worker contracts. And the Pope and the King. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The Trump administration's use of the military to target and kill alleged drug traffickers on vessels it claims are running drugs tops the Week in Review. On Friday morning, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced a 10th strike on a boat he said was carrying narcotics. Six people were blown up on that boat in the Caribbean. Since the beginning of September, the military has carried out multiple strikes, most in the Caribbean, a few in the Eastern Pacific off South America, expanding the administration's campaign against drugs coming into the U.S. from South America. The death toll now totals more than 40 alleged drug traffickers. Some South American leaders say the administration is unlawfully killing innocent fishermen. And U.S. lawmakers from both political parties have expressed concern that Trump is ordering military actions without receiving authorization from Congress or providing proof that the boats are indeed transporting drugs. The president says the strikes are justified as an armed conflict against drug cartels. Here's his answer to a reporter on Thursday who asked him why he does not ask Congress to approve a declaration of war.
I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay, we're going to kill them. You know, they're going to be like dead.
And calling those targeted narco-terrorists and the military action armed conflict against unlawful combatants, the Trump administration is trying to use the same legal authority President George W. Bush used in the war on terror after 9/11. But the strategy remains controversial with critics because it treats unproven drug trafficking claims and alleged drug traffickers as enemy combatants who can be killed without judicial review. The U.S. Army has said it will re-examine key contracts with Catholic lay leaders in its chapels after the Archbishop for the Military Services denounced their cancellation. Contracts for musicians, religious education coordinators, and administrators ended this month. Archbishop Timothy Broglio promised to pursue all legal options against the cancellations, arguing these lay leaders provided vital support for already overburdened Catholic chaplains who are outnumbered by their soldiers 1,000 to 1. He says non-Catholic religious specialists are not trained to be catechists, and many soldiers live in areas where access to Mass and Catholic education can be scarce. In a letter addressed to the faithful of the Archdiocese for the Military Services, Archbishop Broglio wrote, "The Army's action intolerably infringes upon the free exercise of religion for Catholics in the U.S. Army, as well as my responsibility as Archbishop to provide pastoral care to those within my canonical jurisdiction." After the publication of that letter, a spokesperson for the Army told our sister news service Catholic News Agency it will re-examine the contracts of non-Catholic religious specialists to mitigate potential impact. The Archdiocese then said the Army's response is wholly inadequate and does not address its concerns. More than 5 billion people in 62 countries are affected by serious violations of religious freedom. That's according to a report from Aid to the Church in Need released this Tuesday. 38 countries experience discrimination, where religious groups face restrictions on worship, expression, and legal equality. In 24 countries, these groups suffer persecution, grave and systemic violations that lead to repression, arrests, and even violence. Marta Petrosil, managing editor of the report, says in 52 countries, authoritarian rule drives the deterioration of religious freedom.
There is really a difficult life for all the people working as religious priests or sisters in those countries. The regimes are strongly not only controlling but preventing people to enjoy full religious freedom.
Aid to the Church in Need examines religious freedom for many faith groups. The report notes a sharp rise in anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim hate crimes in the wake of Hamas's attack on October 7, 2023, and anti-Christian incidents, including church vandalism and desecration, on the rise in Western countries. A show of pomp, circumstance, and prayer at the Vatican this week as Pope Leo hosted the King and Queen of England. In a historic moment centuries in the making, the Holy Father prayed side by side with King Charles III. In the Sistine Chapel on Thursday, Pope Leo led midday prayer with King Charles, Queen Camilla, and the Anglican Archbishop of York. The music sung by the Sistine Chapel Choir, along with two Royal Chapel Choirs, reflected shared Anglican and Catholic heritage. This is the first time since the 16th century, when the Anglican Church split from Rome, that a pope has publicly prayed with a British monarch, the ceremonial head of the Church of England. Joanna Bogle, Catholic author and historian, says the meeting is a sign of the king's willingness to strengthen ties with the Catholic Church.
I think this was a sort of healing. As is known, His Majesty really, honestly, is a sincere Christian. This is a man who goes to church regularly. He is a believer, and he is very anxious to show ecumenical goodwill. This is not just diplomacy, goodwill, and friendship. This is really praying together. And I think there is a great reverence here, and I'm rather touched by this.
The two leaders also exchanged honorary titles, a sign of the historical ties between the monarchy and the church. His Majesty conferred on Pope Leo the title of Papal Comforter of St. George's Chapel in England, and His Holiness offered Charles the title of Royal Comforter of the Papal Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls in Rome. The basilica now houses a special chair with the royal coat of arms and a Latin phrase meaning that they may be one. It will remain there for his use during future visits. And there will be a lot more room for pomp and circumstance at the White House, as construction has begun for the new ballroom President Trump is adding to the complex. On Monday, heavy equipment started demolition of the 123-year-old East Wing, which historically has housed the offices of the First Lady and served as the entry for guests coming to major social functions. President Trump says the cost of the $300 million grand ballroom is being paid for by private donors and will be able to host up to 999 guests compared to just 200 in the East Room, the White House's current largest space. Here is an architectural rendering of what the ballroom is projected to look like. By Thursday, the East Wing was completely gone, demolished in a pile of rubble. These images show the before and after shots of where the East Wing stood. Completion of the new ballroom is projected before the end of the Trump term. When we come back, the next installment of our reoccurring series on Catholic hub communities around the U.S.
I think what's unique about this community is that there is something for everybody at every stage of life.
The spotlight is on Wichita, Kansas, right after this.
Catholic community to raise their families, more and more Catholics are drawn to the College Hill neighborhood of Wichita, Kansas. This vibrant area is rich in Catholic faith and culture and is the latest Catholic hub EWTN News is highlighting. Reporter Alan Holdren has this Catholic Life report from Kansas.
In the heart of the United States, there's one city where the Catholic community seems to be a step ahead.
Wichita is like, it's like Catholic Disneyland. Well, we have it all. Everything that a Catholic is looking for, it's here.
Not Catholic in a way that is over the top, but a Catholic in a way that is just real. Catholic families, large families living out the faith, a presbyterate that loves the church, authentic liturgies, and really just a belief in Eucharistic adoration, the sacraments, and everything that is Catholic.
Tony Brandt and Chris Stewart run Casting Nets Ministries, which they co-founded. They lead parish missions across the nation, introducing others to the model of Catholic life they've discovered in Wichita.
We have faithful families formed by those faithful priests, and so it just becomes a paradise of Catholicism.
We're reaching into areas of society and into culture and transforming that culture by the way that we live that out.
It starts at the top. Here at the cathedral, the diocese remembers the legacy of those who have cultivated the culture here. Most recently, men like Bishop Eugene Gerber, Bishop Thomas Olmsted, Archbishop Michael Jaeckels, and now Bishop Carl Kemi, who just carried out a successful capital campaign.
With a Catholic population already widely known for its tithing, 2 years ago they set a campaign goal of $50 million. Well, last month, Bishop Kemi announced that they came in at over $60 million. It's not about the money, of course. It's about the effective engagement of the faithful in the life of the church here. So we're on a mission to find out, what is it that makes the Catholic community of Wichita so unique?
At the diocesan chancery next door, Father Jared Lee says the culture is the result of good leadership.
The faithfulness of our bishops, both to the teaching of the church as well as their intense service of the people, just really gave the culture that we have today, which is a moderate, faithful Catholic culture that engages laity in the life of the faith and encourages them to be able to take on their roles and responsibilities.
Father says it's a culture intentionally created through what in Wichita they call the stewardship way of life.
Seeing both the gift inside ourselves as well as the need inside the world that calls us forth to be able to do this work of discipleship.
At all of the city's parishes, there's an expectation for all families to participate fully in the sacraments and adoration, while also tithing of time, talent, and treasure. Catholic education is free for families that buy into the model. To be successful, it's got to be supported by the faithful, people like Becky Meyer at Blessed Sacrament Parish.
Stewardship affects the community because when you are filled up with your identity in Christ through the sacraments and through adoration, and you just ask him, what do you want me to do today? Then he fills in the gaps with that external community, and you're giving back to the community without really thinking about it because you're working through him.
There are 20 Catholic parishes across the city of Wichita. Blessed Sacrament was the first of many to offer perpetual Eucharistic adoration. Here, through school and parish life, a strong sense of belonging is fostered, both inside and outside the buildings.
After Mass and adoration, there's a wide variety of opportunities for formation and community. Gatherings like this youth group, and informal get-togethers like this men's group that meets for a rosary walk, followed by drinks and fellowship, all reinforcing the identity of being children of God and giving a strong sense of belonging for all ages.
It just feels very homey to know your neighbors and to go to church with your neighbors and to walk there each Sunday together.
You just get the sense that there's multi-generations of every family, and people may leave, but they come back, and they get this strong sense of community that brings them back.
Every year, the parish puts on an Oktoberfest celebration, including a 5K run walk for a good cause. The Cots, parish members who took on the walk with their young family this year, find that in general, it's a community motivated by participation in the sacraments and adoration that lives its faith in the streets.
I didn't make dinner for 2 months after having him because all the moms bring meals, and that's just the culture here. And so that culture too makes it just feel so homey, right? It's just they're taking care of our natural needs and our spiritual needs.
It's not some sort of like stage setup. It's just people relating with one another and growing in the relationship with Jesus.
Thy will be done.
Father Jason Borkenhagen, the parish priest here, says the whole parish is ordered towards missionary discipleship.
There's just this commitment to prayer. There's a commitment to the Holy Mass. and all of that feeds into helping the people receive the formation they need to then be able to take that step of kind of trepidation to share their faith with someone else.
Growing up in this culture, young people have the opportunity to discern their vocations well. One of them is third-year seminarian Andrew Meyer, who happens to be the son of stewardship coordinator Becky.
Seeing my parents
participate so much in the life of the parish was definitely very helpful for me. And then being around the priests, they were good role models, and they actually knew me, and I saw how they were a father for their people. And then it's pretty common for us, the Blessed Sacrament, I think, but the Eucharistic adoration.
While other dioceses across the United States are experiencing a dearth of vocations to the priesthood, Andrew is among 51 seminarians currently studying for the Diocese of Wichita.
Here, good leadership, the stewardship model, strong parish life, a focus on vocational discernment for young people, and missionary discipleship have all got people saying there's no place like home. In Wichita, Kansas, Alan Holdren, EWTN News In Depth.
Alan's report is the latest installment in our series highlighting thriving Catholic hubs across the U.S., a collaboration with our sister news service, the National Catholic Register. Learn more about Wichita's thriving community and the latest print edition of the Register, and read previous installments online at ncregister.com. There will be more stories to come about Catholic hub communities in print, online, and here on EWTN News In Depth.
I bought into the idea in seminary that if your bishop asks you to do something, you know, say yes, trusting in the providence that God is bringing you to that place.
When we come back, we introduce you to two priests spearheading a focus on deaf ministry in the Catholic Church in America, their passion, their mission, and why it is so needed.
Like to experience a Catholic Mass without the ability to hear the liturgy, the homily, or the beautiful church music that accompanies it. That is the reality for Catholics who are deaf and have exercised their faith through sign interpreters and other means. But there is a renewed emphasis on reaching out to the deaf Catholic community, thanks to a handful of priests and other Catholic leaders who have made accessibility a top priority. Correspondent Colin Flynn reports in this Faith Journey In Depth.
It's Sunday morning, and at St. Ignatius of Loyola Church in Urbana, Maryland, locals have gathered to celebrate Mass. But this Mass is different, as it caters to a minority but important group in the Catholic Church, those who are deaf.
The Lord be with you.
My full name is Father Michael Stepchik.
Reconcile the human race.
With a vocal interpreter for the hearing members of the congregation, Father Mike Depchik leads the celebration of Mass in sign language.
A man had two sons. The younger son said to his father, "Father, give me my share of your money now."
Father Mike is part of an exclusive club, as there are very few culturally deaf priests in the world. That is, priests who were deaf at birth and grew up in a deaf culture, versus priests who have lost their hearing. It's estimated that there are perhaps 7 in the US, and in total, about 12 in the world.
The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
Unfortunately, research shows that 97% of deaf people do not go to church. And the reason is accessibility. Many of those people who have grown up in hearing families with no communication, they're brought to hearing churches and places of worship and they miss things. But not only that, but also still they have in the Catholic Church a resistance to providing interpreters. They have priests who know sign language, working with the deaf people, but most of the churches are not open to understanding the needs of the deaf community. And I explained that we, as the deaf, are invisible compared with other groups.
Praise you, Lord Jesus Christ.
Father Mike Depchik says that growing up, he was in a privileged position coming from a deaf family. Father Mike, what are your memories of growing up here in the U.S. as a deaf young boy?
Really, I'm very unique because I was born to a deaf family. And that's wonderful for deaf people because 90% of deaf people are born in a hearing family. So I grew up kind of feeling I didn't feel any different than anyone else. I can remember when I was very young, maybe five, we were at a store with my mom. We were in line to pay, and I saw another boy. He was signing, and I thought everyone was deaf. So I was signing, and my mom said, "No, no, no, he's hearing. He doesn't understand you." And I felt sorry for him. I thought there was something wrong with him because he was hearing. And then later, I realized, oh, we are the minority.
And even though he was attending a Catholic school, his faith was not very strong and something he didn't take seriously. And it would take him leaving the Catholic Church to realize his vocation when he was living as an exchange student in Australia.
I lived with a host family, and the family were born again Christians. And they really helped me to find God. That changed my life. It truly inspired me. And I decided to leave the Catholic Church.
It was after returning to the USA that Father Depchik bumped into a priest who asked him if he was Catholic.
And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm Catholic." "Oh, welcome to our church." And I thought, "Oh, I'm stuck." But it did change my life from there on. I was 21 years old, and I was reading a book on Medjugorje, and that really impacted me. That book encourages us to go to confession monthly, to go to Mass, to meet Jesus through the Eucharist, to pray from our hearts. That was when I just became very bold and dreaming about the priesthood.
Now, Father Depchik is celebrating 25 years of his priesthood and is the chaplain for the Deaf Ministry in the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And he says that Deaf Catholics need to have a Mass in their own language and culture. If there is an interpreted Mass, they often feel like passive participants. But with such a small number of Deaf priests, most do not have an option and settle for an interpreter at the side of the altar. However, there is another way, and some hearing priests are starting to pick up the mantle. At the Church of St. Francis of Assisi in Landover Hills, Maryland, Father Patrick Mullen is signing Mass. But the difference is that he is not deaf. He chose to learn sign language to take on this ministry.
I started last summer. I have great teachers. I have a wonderful deaf community that's very excited and supportive. So even in the middle of Mass, if I get stuck, I can turn to them and they can, you know, clarify some sign that I haven't mastered yet. They asked me, and I bought into the idea in seminary that if your bishop asks you to do something, you know, say yes, trusting in the providence that God is bringing you to that place, and that he'll then give you the grace to do it.
Did it seem overwhelming? Because we can get our head around learning a new language. It's a format we're familiar with. But to learn sign language, it must have seemed like just an incredible task to take on.
I would definitely agree with that. there's a certain challenge to not just learning the language, but really the first, from the get-go, the most important thing to the deaf community itself is that you're willing to step into their culture and learn where they're coming from and what they're like.
For centuries, deafness was often misunderstood in the Catholic Church, and some assumed that deaf men could not validly be ordained because of the Church's strong reliance on spoken liturgy, canon law stating that the priest must pronounce the words of the consecration. There were also questions around how they would be able to receive confession and live in community with other non-deaf priests. In fact, it wasn't until 1977 when the first deaf priest was ordained in the United States. And although Father Patrick Mullen signs the entire Mass, he does talk at certain points. For example, the moment of consecration, when the bread and wine become the body and blood of Jesus Christ.
"For this is my body, which will be given up for you."
Yeah, that's actually a choice of mine because I do have my voice, and so I really reserve it for just the words of institution. Perhaps because of, you know, all them theology classes that, you know, really grilled into me, you know, here in the West, like that needs to be said out loud for everybody's hearing. Is it a valid mass if I didn't do that? And the answer to that, as best as I can tell, is yes. You know, the church is ordaining deaf priests now since about 1977, and really wouldn't do so if there was a question about whether or not they can do what priests do and confect the Eucharist and receive confessions.
Father Depchik says he hopes for the day when the deaf community is fully integrated into the Catholic Church. But some dioceses are doing better than others, for example, in well-resourced archdioceses like Washington, D.C.
Christ have mercy.
Mary O'Mara is the executive director of the Office of Deaf and Disability Ministries for the Archdiocese.
It isn't just the provision of liturgy, which is, of course, core and source and summit, but in addition to that, it is an opportunity for the deaf community to gather, to share their faith, to be community, to live out communio, and in response to that, then, to live out missio. So we provide RCIA, we provide marriage prep, catechesis for young children, anything that a parish would provide for community and communal life.
Father Depchik says that as dioceses and parishes around the country cut costs, the deaf ministry is often the first that suffers. And he says that because there are very few priests in the country who know sign language, most deaf Catholics cannot get to the sacrament of confession. And understandably, they do not want an interpreter in the middle. He says that they're also not that well informed about their faith because while other Catholics learn and grow deeper in their faith by watching TV or listening to radio shows, for example, a deaf person doesn't have that option. He says there needs to be more effort put into closed captioning Catholic content.
Finally feeling they have language, finally feeling they have understanding, a self-understanding, that's something that deaf people can offer, that perspective. It's not based on just hearing, it's your whole person. And I think there are many other gifts we have as well.
The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
In the Archdiocese of Washington and Baltimore, Colum Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
What a beautiful story, and may there be continued support for our brothers and sisters in Christ who are deaf or have disabilities of any kind. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.